Blog Talk Radio.
Day of the year, 22nd of December of September here. I know we're getting all excited. We're going to be in balance for at least the second day of the year. Can't guarantee much beyond that, can we? But yeah, the autumnal equinox, sun right over the equator is happening at 3:44 this afternoon. It's wonderful. Exceptional, I would say. Here we have another opportunity to sit down and together and talk about things Masonic. Thank you very much for joining me. And I'll try and make sure that this is educational, informative, entertaining a little bit, I think, I hope. We'll have... the usual edification. Thank you for the response to last week's program. I was quite taken with that. Thank you. That's must be a sign that either this is a good place to tune in and relax, or it is stimulating the little gray cells. We're going to talk a little bit. We'll have some quotes today from Seneca. Maybe something from Epicurus, you know, Epictetus, sorry. Yeah, we'll, not Epicurus, who would want to listen to his work, eh? Ha! But Epictetus would be, you've heard me speak about Epictetus in the past, and you'll see some reference today to what's going on as we continue with our work on character development from that 15th century French writer Montaigne, Michel de Montaigne. And I think you'll find that interesting, yeah, obviously. This is, perhaps it'll be a little bit of a departure today. I'm going to try and not put in so much content. And a little bit, perhaps a little bit of an experiment, just to see if this creates more balance and gives you more of what you're looking for. We're always tweaking little things with Masonic Companion. It's a pleasure to have you here. I have some questions, and I know this is the think tank, so you're sitting back with your favorite glass of Kool-Aid and relaxing. So I have a question. Masonic Companion's version of protocol. What's it called if a lodge ballot returns two black balls? The answer that I have here is electile dysfunction. That's but you come up with your own answer to that one. This is a question regarding somebody named Boaz. I don't know who that was. What kind of man was Boaz before he was married? Ha! Would you say ruthless? Yeah, he married Ruth, but you know, ruthless before he was okay. What's the? Why did the crocodile refuse to eat Freemasons? Because it's kind of obvious they would lodge in its throat. Ah, dear me, I don't know. This is just, I think this is just pure natural humor. How are freeways and Freemasonry alike? Work this one into a conversation. They both provide a pathway to where you want to go. Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, it's a little bit cheesy, but, you know, it's why can't brethren working in Antarctica pass to the Grand Lodge above? Because they're not dead? All right, here's a little verse. Why couldn't the absent-minded brother enter the Grand Lodge above? Because he forgot to bring his regalia there. Oh, dear, I don't know. And where was King Solomon's temple located? Drum roll, please. On the side of his head. I don't know. It doesn't take much. I think it must be just a becoming delusional. That's obviously what that one's about. You know, when I'm finding these kind of things funny, what's it? I don't know. Anyway, judge for yourself. I'm just thinking, this is a call, call out to all of you. Marshall McLuhan said this. He said, I think radio people are far more literate than TV people. So, brethren, consider yourself radio people. And I like to think that Masonic Companion is at least speaking to Masons that are literate and looking for information in a relaxed sort of way. This one will penetrate your thinking through your ears and into your mind, and hopefully it will stimulate some of that, you know, in-head discussion that we all go through when we hear ideas. And you can think that it's half-baked, and you can yell and create your counterpoints. And as well, that if you do that, then I think I've been somewhat successful here. Here's what, you know, we all know Marshall McLuhan was changing the way people were thinking as a philosopher, and the point that some people ponder over the media is the message. Okay, so here are some things that help us, I think, to understand a bit of our own thinking. He says, in the old days, you could pull a trigger on a revolver and hurt people, but today, when you trigger these vast media that we use, you are manipulating entire populations. It gives us pause to think about the responsibility that we share. It's not just sort of a simple bit of machinery. He said to us, nostalgia is the name of the game in every part of our world today. When people have been stripped of their private identities, they develop huge nostalgia. And nostalgia for the jeans and Levi's of the young today are nostalgia for granddad's overalls. His work clothes now become the latest costume. Man, we've talked about the question of whether Freemasonry, you know, that notion of compliance is really a feeding an appetite for nostalgia. The deeper question is why? Why would men have that appetite? Men of some capacity to reason. Why do they have that? Well, here he's saying to us that this is a when people have been stripped of their private identities, they develop huge nostalgia. And I would think, think about it. It's an odd way of thinking about ourselves, but it certainly does have an effect. Paradoxically, the clown is a person with a grievance. His role in medieval society was to be the voice of grievance. The clown's job was to tell the emperor or royalty exactly what was wrong with society. He often lost his head in the process. Really? Really? He said, I put people on. Putting people on means teasing them, challenging them, upsetting them, befuddling them. Any comic puts on his audience by hurting them, to put on as a sort of situation that I study it a good deal. So where do we go with this? He said to us, what you print is nothing compared to the effect of the printed word. Just stop, you know, no drum roll, no giggling, no expansion. But we're sitting down here, we're joining in fraternal conversation. One of the most beautiful qualities of true friendship is to understand and to be understood. Man, you know, Lucius Aeneas Seneca said that. That's not a simple thing to cast aside. It means for all of us, accepting things we don't like to hear. You know, things that aren't politically correct. When we hear them from one another, it has a bite to it, doesn't it? And in and when we hear that, we should realize as Masons, that's the cost of, that's the price of the friendship. Now, you can decide whether it's a price too high to pay. For me, I couldn't tolerate racist comments from brethren. I couldn't tolerate misogynist comments from brethren. There was no fun in it. Homophobic comments, there's no fun. When I, you know, witness the lives of the people that are struck down by those attitudes, I add to them, you know, all my Jewish friends and Italian friends and Chinese friends and Japanese friends and, you know, and the Irish and the Scots and the English, you know, the list just, the French, who hasn't been persecuted and prosecuted for what they, for nothing more than what they are, objectified. And it's the ruthlessness of it's a ruthless game that we play. I couldn't, there are some prices for friendship that I couldn't pay and choose not to. And I think that is, I don't know whether it's a crime or a sin, that's up to you to decide, but it's certainly, there's just things that I just can't find any way of understanding. There's some things that I think as I get older are cruel and narrow and reveal not so much anything about the topic at hand, but more about the person saying it. I'm not a big fan of people's intolerance. And you can say, well, Dale, there you go, you're being intolerant of all these other folks because of their intolerance. Yeah, right. Not going to happen. If one does not know to which port one is sailing, no wind is favorable. Do you not have direction? Just saying the things that come to our mind with no direction is pointless. It's pointless. That's, you know, serving this huge, huge childlike ego. Give me what I want now. Keep me comfortable. And anything that's coming out of my cake hole is accurate and right. You know, anger, if not restrained, is frequently more hurtful to us than the injury that it provokes. That's why perhaps Montaigne has a resonance with some of us, you know. It's not that you walk around in this dreamlike state, you know, chanting as if the world is a meditative opportunity. It's more a matter of understanding and trying to acknowledge what's going on around us and finding our way, finding our course. Equipped with a sense of ethics, you know, it's remarkably important. How do we do that? Who knows? Who knows? It's Life's like a play, he says. This is Seneca. It's not the length, but the excellence of the acting that matters. When we are coming into a Masonic Lodge here, I think it's, I just want to ask why we're never taught about the character that we need to assume when we walk through that door. Being oneself, well, we perform bits of ritual that come from the mystery plays of the guilds, you know, in those days of celebration, those annual celebrations when they could publicly portray a piece of scripture that was defining rank for each of those guilds. No, we didn't have this so-called homogenized sense of democracy that exists here in Canada. And I say so-called because it's just tripe. Well, we're clamoring around to be conformists. It's a conformity within a certain form and structure where we are expected to understand, not necessarily always able to accept, but to understand what's going on around us. And yeah, we do have an important role. If we continue to look at our elected leaders and criticize them for their shortcomings, let's say for the sake of mathematics that we look at all the Masonic leaders that exist today and say they're only about half of what they should be, and then take a closer look at yourself or myself and ask if I'm as complete as I expect others to be. Probably not, huh? Probably not. But you know how we're talking about rough ashlers and perfect ashlers? Well, you know, sorry boys, but the idea wasn't exactly original. Most things, if you can imagine, if you think more seriously about Freemasonry, what it's telling us is that we are derivative. We are a derivative of wonderful ideas. Wonderful ideas. So that one came from Seneca, yeah. Where do you think they went for their work? Just sit around the pub and say, oh, say something clever and I'll write it down and we'll make it Freemasonry? Not quite. Interesting today's topic, time banks. Declare yourself time bankers. This is the day when you're coming up to equinox. Whether you're sitting there listening to me with your regalia lying beside you or not, you are time bankers. When you exist as long as Freemasonry has, you accumulate a history that is remarkable. You will. When you've been around for, what, let's say 14th century, so what, 700 years? And then the ideas. When my friend Tom from out in that, for, or that you know, tropical paradise over west of us, here in Ontario, was talking, asked me a question one day, and he's the kind of fellow that comes up with these little bombs that are just full of information and very thoughtful, and he was asking me if I thought that, you know, Freemasonry had a connection to the Egyptians, and it made me stop, and I thought, well, later I think, well, do you think that the way our parliament is run is being influenced by the development of Greek democracy? I would hope the hell not. But and I would say no more than, you know, the Egyptians had no more or less influence than that. But we have brought forward ideas from that period of time. 4,000 years ago, 4,500 years ago, a little more perhaps. When you exist as long as that, you accumulate a history, and then it's like, you know, what are you? Are you your history? And the singers in the 60s had terms for this, you know. It's like, you know, glory days. It's not necessarily a term from the 60s that's you know, derogatory. Somebody living their glory days as if they don't have anything worthwhile going on in their life today. And I thought, how sad, how grim is that? How grim is that? I don't think I ever met a person yesterday. I always meet them today. I meet you today. And I think if you're going to talk to me about meeting on the level, then I'm saying, well, we may be on the level, but our feet, it's like we're little ducks floating along the surface of a pond, and underneath our feet are wiggling up and down to maintain this balance. And we're going like thunder under there, and I'm doing the same thing. So for me, the level isn't an assumption, it's an effort. It's an achievement, it's an outcome. And that's the way I think about you. That's the way I think about us collectively. To compare and to say, well, the only way I can reason through this and understand is by thinking that the meaning of that is like thinking about a building or something physical, a physical plane that's level. Far from it. This is a metaphor. This is a metaphor. It speaks to our very souls. Do you not want to be known? Can you handle that? Can you handle the fact that you have, that most human beings and most of us have this sense, this chip on our shoulder, that we are, some of us are not even aware that it exists. Some of us, when you are aware, spend a great deal of energy trying to make it disappear. And the chip is about, I'll do it on my own. I don't need anybody else in my life. So we fake it, huh? We fake it. Who actually knows who we are? How much do we reveal? We reveal a lot of fakery, pretense and pretense upon pretense. Doesn't it seem a bit paradoxical to you that we've joined a fraternal order? If that's the point, if we're carrying on as if we have to walk away with this sense that we are in no way in need of the people around us, because we don't know how to handle it. We don't know what to do with it. We don't know it will redefine relationships. So we close down. I don't need to hear that. I don't like that. I can just move away. Well, it's an odd little world. So I'm talking here about the history. When you accumulate that history, it's like we become redefined, and it reveals things about us because it exposes us. You know, for those lines where we're saying everything that we do is recorded. Well, it's recorded in your mind. Your conscience, it reflects on it repeatedly. What does it tell you about your character? And get over this. Get over it. Oh, we can always do better. Jeez. Try and achieve a deeper understanding of what's going on. It's not about, you know, we're not children. We can always do better. What in the hell is that about? Though thousands of men have been initiated, our antiquarians have distilled the greatest ideas, most prosaic advice, the interpretations of an engaging philosophy of life, about life, the workings of serious minds. We find our libraries straining with papers, including history that has been modified to support certain points. Myth and fable folded into fact and faith with an almost sacred preserve. Yeah, we do that. The ideas of ancient times and our understanding of them are being constantly improved. When archaeologists find new papyrus or parchments, our scriptures are rewritten, revealing more about our past. Our appreciation of history now includes an awareness that revisionists had a heavy hand, energizing our scholars to verify information.
Curiously, the history of Freemasonry is undergoing upgrades, changing the way we think. What does this reveal about the order? It would appear our need to know is replacing dogma. In the 21st century, the vibrancy of Freemasonry has sharpened. We are now able to face cynics and critics who would say we are a shadow of what we once were, with a voice that reminds us Freemasonry has constantly been evolving. So I put to you, the brain trust out there, a simple question. Why is the best masonry in the world found in those jurisdictions with the strongest Grand Lodge? You define strength. Oh, we don't have walls, we don't have buildings, we just have, you know, this fundamental idea. And of course, everybody out there is a philosopher king. Yeah, fine. Have England, Scotland, Sweden, or Belgium found the lodestone, or are they landmarks that point the way to our future? It is possible we have the exact membership blend to make our future strong. Would you know? Well, pay attention. It's there. This is what I say to you. This is a challenge. We have exactly the membership blend we need to be a strong voice in Freemasonry, to preserve and develop the strength within each one of us and as an order. Are we up to the challenge that only contemplation will resolve? I'm thinking we are. Do you? Something? Then you can read about that. You can read that. I know that when you listen to me, it may be a little quick for a lot of those ideas to be, you know, digested. You're time bankers. You are a vault where information can be stored and be brought out when it's needed. Well, I'm saying, boys, we need it. And why would you ever do it? Because we need you. We need your opinion to add to the cacophony of opinion out there. Your opinion is legitimate unless you know within yourself that it's half-baked. If you try and sell something, don't embarrass. You know, if you're trying to convey an idea, it's not sell. It's conveying an idea is worthwhile. Make sure that it is. Not just something that you've read and you're thinking, well, it's adding information where I only had a blank spot in my understanding before. That may be your experience, but put it into context. Go and look and compare the data. What does the data around that topic say about the new information that you've discovered? Can you in some way validate it, or can you build on it? Is it that hard to believe that time is allowing us to improve? Well, if we had grown a pair and had a spine, we wouldn't be sitting there pouting about things getting worse today than they were in the good old days. Hell, they were better in the good old days. They're better today. There you go. Masonry, better, bigger, larger today. We have history. We have a dynamic energy. We have ways of communicating ideas that were not there before. And if we can't figure it out, we have brilliant minds like Marshall McLuhan to tell us, point it out, and let us chew on the ideas and savor them. Freemasonry is ideas, isn't it? You want to do it alone? Do it alone. You don't need permission to do that. But this idea that everything worthwhile is something from the past, there is a value in the past. And yeah, I don't agree with some of the European Masons that I've met, especially fellows that I've had an opportunity to get to know from the Grand Lodge of Scotland or Grand Lodge of Canada, that the best was of the past. Brilliant ideas are timeless. Brilliance is timeless. Now, we can marvel when we discover that some science that we think is cutting edge was actually referred to before, but it was never written down. It was never measured. It was a freestanding idea. And we can say, well, today, you know, that applies to quantum physics. Well, of course we knew that. Look at the work that the Greeks did about dust spots, you know, and molecular structure. But you couldn't work with it. You couldn't develop the idea until you get into these contemporary environments where we can start to measure and start to build and develop these ideas. We have we're fortunate. We live in a world with so many brilliant minds that we can witness and experience around us, or we can find and build a world of solace and contemplation. Whether it's urban and the pace is not to your liking, it means that it's somebody else's pace, not yours. What makes somebody else's pace good or bad? It's the same as yours. It is what it is. If you don't like driving on the major highway, don't drive on it. You want to get all pouty and say it's too fast? Well, so what? Don't drive on it. Find a path. Find a dirt road. Find a means of transportation that works for you. You want a crank phone? Get a crank phone. You want to pedal your way down to Hamilton? Go and pedal your way down. Nobody's going to look twice at you, look askance at the project. You're fine. But remember, you're defining yourself. Freemasonry is that step, defining who you are. So we can think and be and aware of our desires, where our ethical course does not depend on trying to find favor, constantly trying to find favor, trying to maneuver, trying to be strategic. You become who you are and what you are. Let me move on here. Is that all right? Do you go okay with that? I don't know. I think sometimes Freemasonry is just sort of startlingly revealing. It's like it strips away all the baggage. It's amazing. Do you never notice that we lie when people dress, even our clothes? We begin to lie. Freemasonry strips a lot of stuff away. The unvarnished truth, huh? And then you have what you have. The art of living well and the art of dying well are one, said Epicurus. Brilliant. It is folly for a man to pray to the gods for that which he has the power to obtain by himself. Oh, you mean like God as Santa Claus? Let me say to you, I'm really screwed up, but if you help me out and give me this one, I'll reform myself and I'll be a better person. So, Santa God, just give me this one more favor. I'm screwed here without this. So just give me this one and then so if I don't amount to much, I really don't have to take much responsibility for myself. I can blame that on everybody. Don't you wish everybody had the faculty and the resource to be able to sit back and contemplate? Would it be a better world? We're clamoring for the world to be like us. People want to live like us. And why shouldn't they? Too crowded? Consumption of too much resource? Well, we didn't have a problem with it. My good friend tells me that all is, you know, you look at Scotland and the scrub growth, but once upon a time, like Europe and England, it was covered with tall forests, and they were all cut down. We're doing a pretty good job hacking away. What are we on, second or third growth here across Canada? Now we have disease coming up the coasts, and it's not like those bad countries are doing anything. The world has always been like this. If it wasn't on a ship or because of the movement of human beings, it would be on the air currents. Don't think that we're that different than, you know, how long have we been around? We've been around as long as the dinosaurs. And bless his little heart, Epictetus tells us only the educated are free. That's you. We have two ears and one mouth, so we can listen twice as much as we speak. Now, Epictetus is making me self-conscious. So for the next 20 minutes of silence, I'll be sitting here talking less. Try to demonstrate I will listen. All right. If you want to improve, be content to be thought of as foolish and stupid. Yeah, I have the advantage of reading the quotations of a brilliant mind. It is a wise man who does not grieve for the things which he does not have, but rejoices for those things which he has. Why would I want to be anywhere else than my backyard with a friend, a book, a glass of wine? It is the nature of the wise to resist pleasures, but the foolish to be a slave to them. Balance, eh? You want balance? You want to be on the level? There you go. Can you do that one? It is the nature of the wise to resist pleasures, but the foolish to be a slave to them. So it's that say about, conspicuous consumption. The nouveau riche? A bit tedious, isn't it? Imagine for yourself a character, a model personality whose example you determine to follow in private as well as in public. Imagine for yourself. If thy brother wrongs thee, remember not so much his wrongdoing, but more than ever that he is thy brother. It's hard, isn't it? It's very hard. If evil be spoken of you, and it be true, correct yourself. If it be a lie, laugh at it. That one, try that one. That one stings. When you have these false accusations being weighed, when you're being mocked, try that one. It stings. But man, is it satisfying when you figure it out. The sting does go away. It changes. But the lesson is life-changing. Difficulties are things that show a person what they are. Remember, it's how you adapt. You get feedback from us. You get feedback from your brethren. What you do with that feedback defines you. It's self-directed. Is freedom anything else than the right to live as we wish? Nothing else. Nothing else. Here, wealth consists not in having great possessions, but in having few wants. There is only one way to happiness, and that is to cease worrying about things which are beyond the power of our will. Sad day this week. I'll give you some sad news. A very, very interesting man. Some of you may have met this fellow, Robert Stillwell. On Thursday, he passed away. May God bless his soul. He was the immediate past Grand Senior Warden. It's an office I now have the honor of holding. Thank you to the voters across Ontario. Different perspective when you realize that the ballot that you stood for was provincial. Yeah, It is humbling. Do you mind if I talk to you a little bit about, just to, as we remember him? He was the last time I saw him was over in Fenland Falls, and he was sitting down, and he knew then that I was one of the people standing for election. And he was in earnest teaching me and talking to me about his experiences and giving me cautions, very serious-minded fellow. And it was like he wanted me to know everything about his year, compressed into, you know, maybe a half an hour, 45 minutes. But he always had time. And for him, it was important. For him, it was an important act of dedication. And I hope that that has influenced me in the way that I conduct myself in the... It's already started. So I'm going to reflect a little bit about and remember him by doing what he passed on for me. A little bit of education here. A little bit of information. Ward is a medieval origin, having been used in early English, French, and German, always in the sense of to guard something. A meaning preserved in warden, guard, guardian, wary, wear, ward. A warden is guardian of the west gate of the temple, the junior warden of the south gate. In every symbolic lodge, there are three principal officers, namely a master, a senior warden, and a junior warden. This rule has existed ever since the revival, and for some time previous to that extent, and is so universal that it has been considered as one of the landmarks. It exists in every country and in every rite. The titles of the officers may be different in different languages, but their functions as presiding over the lodge as a tripartite division of duties are everywhere the same. The German Masons call the two wardens Erst and Zweit Aufseher, the French Premier and Second Surveillant, the Spanish Premier and Segundo Vigilante, and the Italians Primo and Secondo Sorvegilante. I love that. Sorvegilante. So I'm primo? Yeah. You're secondo. In the various rites, the positions of these officers vary. In the American rite, the senior warden sits in the west and the junior in the south. In the French and Scottish rites, both wardens are in the west. The junior in the northwest and the senior in the northwest and the junior in the southwest. But in all, the triangular position of the three officers relatively to each other is preserved. For a triangle being formed within the square of the lodge, the master and wardens will each occupy one of the three points. The precise time when the presidency of the lodge was divided between these three officers, or when they were first introduced into Masonry, is unknown. The lodges of Scotland during the operative regime or era were governed by a deacon and one warden. The Earl of Cassillis was master of Kilwinning in 1670, though only an apprentice. This seems to have been not unusual, as there are cases of apprentices presiding over lodges. The deacon formed the functions of a master, and the warden was the second officer, and took charge of and distributed the funds. In other words, he acted as a treasurer. This is evident in the minutes of the Edinburgh Lodge, published by Brother Leon Lyon, by the head of the craft. But the head of the craft in Scotland at the time was called the Warden General. This regulation, however, does not appear to have been universal, even in Scotland. For in the Mark Book of the Aberdeen Lodge, you know, over toward the east coast of Scotland, up around, by the way, where the Graham clan was, and they, under date of December 27, 1670, which was published by Brother W.J. Hewan in the Voice of Freemasonry, February 1872. Well, I don't know if I still have that magazine on my shelf. You fellas probably, some of you are that old, you probably still have it in its original wrapper. We find there are a master and warden recognized as the presiding officers of the lodge in the following statute. And likewise, we all protest by the oath we have made at our entry to own the warden of our lodge as the next man in power to the master. And in the master's absence, he is full master. There you go. Some of the English manuscript constitutions recognize the offices of master and wardens. Thus, the Harleian manuscript, number 1942, whose date is supposed to be around 1670, contains the new article said to have been agreed on at a general assembly held in 1663, and which is the following passage: that for the future, the said society, company, and fraternity of free masons shall be regulated and governed by one master and assembly and wardens. As you said, company shall think fit to choose at every yearly general assembly. So we have the turnaround. As the word warden does not appear in the earlier manuscripts, it might be concluded that the office was not introduced into the English lodges until the later part of the 17th century. Yet this does not absolutely follow. For the office of warden might have existed, and no statutory provisions on the subject have been embraced in the general charges, which are contained in these manuscripts, because they relate not to the government of lodges, but the duties of Freemasons. You've heard the ancient charges? It's not about the government of the lodge at all, is it? This, of course, is conjectural. But the conjecture derives weight from the fact that wardens were officers of the English guilds as early as the 14th century. In the charters granted by Edward III in 1354, was Edward III, Edward, he wasn't the Hammer of Scotland. No, that was the first, wasn't it? I don't know if I'm... It is permitted that these companies shall yearly elect for their government a certain number of wardens. To a list of the companies of the date of 1377 is affixed what is called the Oath of the Wardens of the Craft. Of which this is the commencement. We shall were that we ye shall wield and truly oversee the craft of whereof ye be chosen wardens for the year. It thus appears that the wardens were at first the presiding officers of the guilds. Trying to multitask here, trying to sip a coffee, listening to you. No, it was Edward the First. He was a bit of a, not a nice man, especially after his wife died. He really has turned a bit rabid, I think. But anyway, I digress. At a later period in the reign of Elizabeth, we find that the chief officer began to be called master. And in the times of James I, between 1603 and 1625, the guilds were generally governed by a master and wardens. An ordinance of the Leather Sellers Company at that time directed that on a certain occasion the master and wardens shall appear in state. It is not therefore improbable that the government of Masonic lodges by a master and two wardens was introduced into the regulations of the order in the 17th century, the, quote, new article of 1663 being a statutory confirmation of a custom which had just begun to prevail. Senior warden. He is the second officer in a symbolic lodge and governs the craft and the hours of labor. In the absence of the master, he presides over the lodge, appointing some brothers, not the junior warden, to occupy his place in the attest. His jewel is a level, a symbol of the equality which exists among the craft while at labor in the lodge. His seat is in the west, and he represents the column of strength. He has placed before him and carries in all possessions a column, which is the representative of the right-hand pillar which stood at the porch of King Solomon's temple. The junior warden has a similar column, which represents the left-hand pillar. During labor, the column of the senior warden is erect in the lodge, while that of the junior is recumbent. At refreshment, the position of the columns is reversed. The junior warden, the duties of this officer have already been described. There is also an officer in a commandery of Knights Templar, the fifth in rank, who is styled the senior warden. He takes an important part in the initiation of a candidate. his jewel of office is a triple triangle, the emblem of deity. The office of wardens is very old, older probably than any reference we shall ever find in documents relating to the craft. Although our organization, all through our organization, the influence of the guilds in the Middle Age may be traced, occasionally with ease, but often with the methods of a higher criticism, which reads analogies by inference and logical interpretation of the spirit of the document. The Freemasonry derived its wardens from the guilds, however, needs no very critical labor to suggest. The guilds of the Middle Age acted under royal charters or warrants or similar instruments given by more local authority. This legal protection enabled them to work with more freedom for the good of all and gave the chartering authority some semblance of control. In the Libra Albus, or White Book of the City of London, 1419, we find the oath of the masters and wardens of the mysteries. That was 1419, 15th century, which was applicable to any guild, weavers, metalworkers, masons, or others. And it reads, "You shall swear that well and lawful you shall overlook the art of mystery of, let's say, metalworkers, of which you are masters and wardens of the mysteries, for the year elected, and the good rules and ordinances of the same mystery. Approved here by the court, you shall keep and cause to be kept. And all the defaults that you shall find therein, done contrary thereto, you shall present to the chamberlain of the city from time to time, sparing no one for favor, and aggrieving no one for hate. Extortion or wrong unto no one by color of your office you shall do, nor unto anything that shall be against the estate and peace of the king or of the city you shall consent. But for the time that you shall be in office, in all things pertaining unto the said mystery, according to the sacred mystery, according to the laws and franchises of the said city, well and lawfully you shall behave yourself. So God help you and the saints. Behave yourself." The Harleian manuscript, the probable date of which is around 1660, states that for the future of the said society, company and fraternity of Freemasons shall be regulated and governed by one master of the assembly and wardens, as the said company shall think to choose at every yearly general assembly. It seems strange to modern ears, but it is a fact that the wardens of a lodge, prior to some date between 1723 and 1738, were always chosen from the fellows of the craft. In the first edition of Anderson's Constitution, that was published in 1723, wasn't it? Yeah. Under the manner of constituting a new lodge, as practiced by His Grace the Duke of Wharton, the present Right Worshipful Grand Master, according to the ancient usages of Masons, we read, "The new master and wardens being yet among the fellow craft, after the newly elected master is installed, he calls forth two fellow craft, presents them to the Grand Master for his approbation, and when that is secured, they are duly installed as wardens. The three principal officers of a lodge are universally recognized in the ritual as the essential elements of which the lodge must consist. Only the uninstructed Mason regards the stations of the senior and junior wardens as but stepping stones to the east, necessary waiting posts to which the ambitious must stand hitched for a year before proceeding on his triumphal journey to the Oriental chair. Not only are the wardens essential to every entered apprentice's fellow crafts or master mason's lodge, but they have certain inherent powers, duties, and responsibilities." Now, you can get, if you have a copy of Mackey's or Mackay's dictionary, you can find all of this information. I'm not going to go really through it. No other brethren in the lodge have this power, privilege, and responsibility. They're talking about the influences of the three offices. The wardens are found in all bodies of masonry, in all rites, and in all countries. In the French Rite and Scottish Rite, both wardens sit in the west near the columns in the, I don't like the term, this is the American version, Blue Lodge, the Craft Lodge. The symbolism is somewhat impaired by the junior warden sitting in the south, but it is strengthened by giving each warden a replica of the column beneath the shade of which he once sat. It is interesting to note that these columns once went by another name. Ah, Oliver quotes an inventory of the lodges in Chester in 1761, which includes two truncheons, or columns. They are the warden's emblems of authority, and their positions are of great interest. The column of the senior warden is erect to that of the junior warden on its side when the lodge is at labor. Who knew? The government of the craft by a master and two wardens cannot be too strongly emphasized to the initiate or too well observed by the craft. Only wardens may succeed to the office of master. The fourth of the old charges reads, no brother can be a warden until he has passed the part of a fellow craft, nor a master unless he has acted as warden, nor grand warden until he has been master of a lodge, nor grand master unless he has been fellow craft before his election. Prior to the formation of the Mother Grand Lodge of England in 1717, it was the prerogative of every Mason to be present at the General Assembly and to have his voice in its affairs. When the Grand Lodge was brought into being by the four old lodges of London, the interests of all were entrusted to the masters and wardens. Preston states that the masters and wardens of all regular particular lodges upon record formed the Grand Lodge. Of the action of Grand Lodges which deprived the wardens of membership in the Grand Lodge, Mackay states, I cannot hesitate to say that this is not only a violation of the ancient regulations, but an infraction of the inherent rights of the wardens and lodges. There. Let's remember Robert Stilwell. Interesting man. An interesting fella, you got to admit. Now, a reference to Edward, the king, Edward I was Longshanks. He was just a tall guy. He picked that title up later. He wasn't exactly well liked by he later picked up the got a little bit ticked with some Scottish boys that tried to kick his rear end off of Scotland. So I'm, you know, so be it. Now, do you mind if we talk a little bit about developing a little character, and then we'll slip off into our usual slumber and relax and enjoy the rest of our whatever we've got going on. I hope you're all doing well out there, by the way. It's not a dog-eat-dog world unless you're thinking about it that way. It's an interesting world that we're in, and we somehow we've all discovered Freemasonry. I'd hate the hell to think that we all did this because somebody else told us it was a good idea. I really don't want to believe that. I want to think that there's some original thought going on. Do you mind? Here's a little bit of what Montaigne wrote on the roof beams of his house. So, you know, you have these ideas around you. Now, this is an idea you might want to borrow for yourself. When you find these things inspirational, let's lie to me and tell me that when you're listening to this, sometimes I blurt out something that's inspirational. If you just say that because it soothes my soul, fine, I'm good at that. But it's the idea. Now, if you find an idea resonates and you think that it really is the kind of influence that you need in your character, this fellow brought them into his environment. You and I can do the same. We do the same symbolically. You know, fellows that have a bust of a Roman. You might have a bust of one of your favorite or influential Greek philosophers. In my case, it would probably be what? Epictetus. You might want Socrates. And after you hear this, you might want Euripides or Sophocles. Yeah? Here's a little bit of what he had written. He said, on the beams, and they faded after a while and they had to be redone. But he considered them like voices whispering above his head. Just think, these ideas are voices, and put voices to them. Somebody actually said these words once, and it was in its original form. And maybe he was, just like you and I, you're pulling together a few really good ideas, and that he had heard in conversation. Makes me often you know, as I was growing up, you came to that realization in my early 20s that there wasn't, you know, I was thinking about original thought, and I realized it, or I came to this awareness that I didn't know what an original thought was, and my head was full of everything that was derivative that I'd heard from other people. I felt at the time particularly bad about that. I don't know quite sure why. I was thinking maybe I was thinking that I should be, you know, take a step forward like other men had and make a contribution. And as a student, you know, that's what you're training to do. You're not in any position to necessarily do that. How can you think yourself a great man when the first accident that comes along can wipe you out completely? Euripides said that. And Montaigne applied that to one of his roof beams. Only one thing is certain, that nothing is certain, and nothing is more wretched or arrogant than man. Pliny the Elder is claimed to be the first historian, Pliny the Elder. And I have it in, you want it in Latin? Solum certum nihil esse certi. There you go, same thing. There is no more beautiful life than that of a carefree man. Lack of care is a truly painless evil. Lack of care is a truly painless evil. That's Sophocles. I only have it here in that English and in Greek, and I can't read Greek. Not even going to begin. The beams were a vivid reminder of Montaigne's decision to move from public life into a meditative existence, a life to be lived literally under the sign of philosophy rather than that of politics. Such a shift of realms was also part of the ancients' advice. The great Stoic Seneca, who we've quoted here earlier today, repeatedly urged his fellow Romans to retire in order to find themselves, as we might put it. In the Renaissance, as in ancient Rome, it was part of the well-managed life. You had your period of civic business, then you withdrew to discover what life was really about and to begin the long process of preparing for death. Montaigne developed reservations about the second part of this, but there was no doubt about his interest in contemplating life. He wrote, "Let us cut loose from all the ties that bind us to others. Let us win from ourselves the power to live really alone and to live that way at our ease." Seneca, in advertising retirement, had also warned of dangers. In a dialogue called The On Tranquility of Mind, he wrote that idleness and isolation could bring to the fore all the consequences of having lived life in the wrong way. Consequences that people usually avoided by keeping busy, that is, by continuing to live life in the wrong way. The symptoms could include dissatisfaction, self-loathing, fear, indecisiveness, lethargy, and melancholy. You and I hear old boys acting this way. We just simply say they're grumpy. Here's what's going on behind the eyes. If you think that the pain is only directed externally, you'd be wrong. In the early 1570s, though, during his shift of values, Montaigne seems to have suffered exactly the existential crisis Seneca warned of. He had work to do, but less of it than he was used to. The inactivity generated strange thoughts and a melancholy humor, which was out of character for him. No sooner had he retired, he said, than his mind galloped off like a runaway horse. An apt comparison, considering what had recently happened. Remember, we read about him falling off, having one of his staff ride into him. Montaigne being on a smaller animal, and this, you know, you'd think about it today and think, idiot, you're riding down a path and you run down your boss and then damn near kill him. Probably not a good career move, you know. His reverie, in turn, gave Montaigne another mad idea, the thought of writing. This is how things all poured out. finding his mind so filled with chimeras and fantastic monsters, one after another, without order or purpose, he decided to write them down, not directly to overcome them, but to inspect their strangeness at his leisure. So he picked up his pen, and the first of the essays was born. Seneca would have approved. If you become depressed or bored in your retirement, he advised, just look around you and interest yourself in the variety and sublimity of things. Salvation lies in paying full attention to nature. Montaigne tried to do this, but he took nature primarily to mean the natural phenomena that lay closest to hand, himself. He began watching and questioning his own experience and writing down what he observed. At first, this meant mainly following his own personal enthusiasms. So he began reading tales from Ovid, histories of Caesar and Tacitus, the biographical snippets from Plutarch, the advice on how to live from Seneca and Socrates. There you go. Writing had got Montaigne through his mad reveries crisis, and now taught him to look at the world more closely, and increasingly gave him the habit of describing inward sensations and social encounters with precision. He quoted Pliny on the idea of attending to such elusive fragments. Each man is a good education to himself, provided he has the capacity to spy on himself from close up. As Montaigne the man went about his daily life on the estate, Montaigne the writer walked behind him, spying and taking notes. In truth, however hard you try, you can never retrieve an experience in full. As a famous line by the ancient philosopher Heraclitus has it, you cannot step into the same river twice. Even if you return to the same spot in the bank, different water flows in upon you at every moment. Similarly, to see the world exactly as you did half an hour ago is impossible, just as it is impossible to see it from the point of view of a different person standing next to you. The mind flows on and on, in a ceaseless stream of consciousness, a phrase coined by the psychologist William James in 1890, though it was later made more famous by novelists. Montaigne was among the many who quoted Heraclitus, and he mused on how we are carried along by our thoughts. So think, you cannot step into the same river twice. Everything changes around us. Every day a new fancy, now gently, now violently, according to the water, is angry or calm, and our humors shift with the shifts in the weather. And it is no wonder that the mind is like this, since even the apparently solid physical world exists in endless slow turmoil. Looking at the landscape around his house, Montaigne could imagine it heaving and boiling like porridge. His local river carved out its banks as a carpenter's chisel grooves in wood. He had been astonished by the shifting sand dunes of Medoc, near where one of his brothers lived. The world was a cosmic wobble, a shimmy. Other 16th century writers shared Montaigne's fascination with the unstable. What was unusual in him was his instinct that the observer is as unreliable as the observed. Two kinds of movement interact like variables in a complex mathematical equation, with the result that one can find no secure point from which to measure anything. What we're seeing is moving, and we're moving, and the experience moves. And there you have enough of Montaigne, I think, for at least for today. A little something to keep us into a bit of perspective. So if I see I come over to your house and I see scribbles and quotations on the ceiling above, of course, nearest to your head, well, I'll certainly understand. As Epicurus said, I have never wished to cater to the crowd. For what I know, they do not approve, and for what they approve, I do not know. Nothing is enough for the man to whom enough is too little. Ah. Now, that kind of stuff almost gives me pause to think that there's more to, there's more that I should be focusing on. Just a little blurb. Quite a little bit of blurb from French Freemasonry. Are you into that? A little more context. A little more. You want to be a little more worldly. Work this again. Work these into your Masonic conversations. You know, they can be a real gut buster, I think. I tend to think that you might find something worthwhile in some of this. But, you know, that's up to you. I'm going to give you just, you know, a little bit of a, I don't know if I'd call it comic relief, a recently raised Master Mason applied for a job, and knowing his prospective boss to be a prominent Mason, he made sure to wear his square and compass cufflinks. It's compasses, sir. Excuse me. This is from Harold Herman in Unity Lodge in New South Wales, Australia. It's square and compasses. When he arrived at the interview, he approached his interviewer in the regular manner and proceeded to shake hands. After an hour or so, with the candidate dropping numerous Masonic references, the prospective boss asked if he were to be offered a job, what package would he expect? Our candidate, now feeling very confident, said he would like $200,000 and 5 weeks of annual leave. His interviewer said, "We'll have it, and you begin." Oh. Begin you. You. Dear. There you go. The master of the lodge and his two wardens went golfing one day. As they were about to tee off from the first hole, the course master came and asked if a young woman could join their group. Being a charitable group, they all agreed. She turned out to be a scratch golfer, but on the 18th hole, she drove the green in two and was about to putt for eagle. She then asked the three brothers if any one of them helped her make the putt, she would be eternally grateful. Well, then the junior warden looked at the putt and told her it was uphill and broke to the right. The senior warden, being a more expert workman, looked at it second and said, "This is partially correct, but 5 inches from the hole, it breaks back to the left." Well, the master of the lodge then took his turn. He looked at the putt carefully and then went over to the ball, picked it up, and exclaimed, "That's a gimme." Bada bing, bada boom. Philosophy from the golf course. And I know there are a few of you listening into Masonic Companion with your putter in hand. There you go. And you can probably, I hope you can play this back and listen to that one. That's there you go. I liked it. What can I tell you? Do I feel a little bit, I'm going to come back. I'm not really, you know, we'll have to come back to Freemasonry in France. Just, I'm going to close off today. You can get rid of me here. It's been good having you here. But I want to finish with some material. This is from a book called Freemasonry, It's History and Myths Revealed by Giles Morgan. I wonder if he's any relation to that guy that disappeared after he said he was going to print the secrets. Yeah. Morgan, John Mark. Freemasonry in the modern, as Freemasonry became less secretive about its activities, the extent to which its reach into many areas became apparent, creating an almost inevitable backlash of accusation and conspiracy theories. This is a little bit of a cold shower for us, you know, a little bit of a check. Perhaps I hope when you hear a little bit about this, you read this, you listen to this, it will make it apparent that to carry ourselves with arrogance would be a serious mistake. To act as if we have the world by the ass would be a serious, uncommon mistake and in bad taste. If in nothing else, this, I think, is being glib, being thoughtless, bringing up some of the rhetoric from the past that was aimed, targeted, especially all those references from Taxil about goats and things, be very careful. My goodness, this is the world we live in. You want to hear it? While a diverse and famous range of individuals, including such figures as Churchill and Oscar Wilde and John Wayne, have been Freemasons, the public image of the craft in the modern era has been often a negative one. Conspiracy theories implicating Masonry and plans for world domination have abounded, and Freemasons have often found themselves at the receiving end of bigotry and intolerance. Amen to that. The reputation of Freemasonry was dealt a serious blow in the late 19th century by the so-called exposés of one Gabriel Gauguin Pogues, writing under the pseudonym of Leo Taxil. Born in 1854 in the French city of Marseille, Gauguin Pogues became a journalist, and after moving to Paris, produced a newspaper that focused largely on scandal and intrigue. He also wrote a number of contentious books with a similar slant in content and titles such as The Secret Lovers of Pope Pius IX. He became a Freemason in 1881. Now, there's a little lesson learned. You know, you're given a ballot for a reason, letting in the wrong person. Here, listen to the consequences here. He was eventually rejected by the Brotherhood. Subsequently, Gauguin Pogues adopted Catholicism and, perhaps inspired by the Catholic hatred of Freemasonry, wrote a number of books exposing the secrets of Freemasonry, entitled The Secret Revelations of French Masonry. The books portrayed Freemasons as satanic devil worshippers who engaged in the most appalling and debased behavior during their rites and rituals. The books of Leo Taxil were to prove an incredible popular success throughout Europe. His books on Freemasonry were also particularly anti-Semitic in their content, and his vivid descriptions of Masonic secret ceremonies were fantastical and demonic. Taxil insisted that the punishment for Masons who betrayed the secrets of the Brotherhood was potentially death, and that all Masons, as part of their oath or charge of allegiance, must be ready to commit murder. While many within Freemasonry objected publicly to his distortion of the image of the Brotherhood, he was, perhaps not surprisingly, supported in his attack on the craft by the Catholic Church. The Pope of the day, Leo XIII, went so far as to award Leo Taxil the special honor of the Order of the Holy Sepulchre as a reward for his attacks on Freemasonry. Grim, grim, grim. What in the world are we coming out of? But like when we're together again, I'm going to talk to you about Annie Besant. And she was a leading member of the Theosophical Society, a mentor of the spiritual teacher and the spiritual teacher of J. Krishnamurti, successfully established mixed Freemasonry in England. There's a lot to be learned. Anyway, we'll come back to this. We have notes on Golden Dawn, women in Freemasonry. The world is changing around us, and you and I are moving as well as all of that, and perhaps a bit more. So, do we have more to please ourselves? I think so. Anyway, it's been very gratifying to have you join me again this morning. I hope that you're doing well. I look forward to being with you again, seeing you in Lodge. I'm going to be down in Toronto attending a Lodge of Instruction. Who knows? We may have a chance to sit in Lodge together again real soon. I want to thank the fellows over at Manitou Lodge in Collingwood for their hospitality, especially for the new Grand Senior Warden. In the meantime, until we see each other again, take good care of yourselves and each other. Look forward to being with you again. It's a little music that I like. Young man, young woman called Civil Wars. Cheers. Bye.